Harvest Messages are brought to you by Harvest Partners. To receive free email daily devotions or to become a Harvest Partner, please visit us online at harvest.org.
Well, the moment that you've all been waiting for, I'm going to do a dance interpretation. And that would be nice. But again, a lot of you guys ask, well, who's speaking tonight? Some of you actually came up to me earlier and I told you. You know, hey, I'll let you know. But the person that we brought in today you guys are going to be blessed. Been a high school coach for many years here locally. You probably recognize him around town. He's actually won 6 state championships, 5 in a row, which is a state record. 24 years undefeated. Amazing. 140 league championship between the girls and the boys. Actually, he's in the Riverside Hall of Fame if you go downtown Riverside. And it's been great just to hear that part of it. I told you those things because he wouldn't tell you that. Humble guy. But, at Harvest, we've told you before that, we don't choose pastors. God calls them, and we just recognize that calling. And we've brought some new guys on to the pastoral staff, like Pastor Marty, like Adam Eaton, like my son Brad Jr. But tonight, you're going to be blessed. You probably have utilized his ministry years and years as he's been doing it, because he's done such a great job. I can tell you that Pastor Billy York was at our pastor's meeting not too long ago and gave us his testimony. And I thought, oh my goodness, I did not know this about him. And it's just such a riveting testimony of God's goodness and God's grace and his mercy and his miracles that I told him I need to have you share that with the guys tonight. So please welcome Pastor Billy York.
Well, aren't you glad for Pastor Brad? You can pick him out in the crowd. Well, I'm excited to be here. I have to say, when I pulled up here, there were so many men. I just felt like we should do something, because men love to do something like build a skyscraper or a suspension bridge or something with all these men around here. And I tell you what, and I work in the children's ministries and been there. My wife and I have been married 45 years in February. And we've been working 40 years, not working, but being blessed 40 straight years nonstop in the children's ministries. And most of our teachers and workers are women. And I tell you what, I get very, very excited when I see a man of God, especially for the sake of the children. Because so many children have the wrong impression what a man of God is. To them, a man is who has the biggest body count, as they see in the movies, the ones that can beat up people the most. That's a man. But there's a big difference between that man and a man of God. So bless you for being here. I'm here to share my testimony. I was asked, and I just want to say right up front, it's not about me. It's about what God has done. What God has done. And I have a friend here tonight. And his name is Ben Nunley. Would you stand up, Ben Nunley? Where are you at? Okay. And so Ben Nunley, throughout the week, knew I was going to speak, and he kept going, are you nervous yet? It's good. Show me, they're going to be looking at you and listening to you. Are you nervous? So would somebody please hit him right now? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I feel so much better. All right. Good. Good, good, good. Okay. Well, I cannot share my testimony without talking about my parents. And my father was born under unusual circumstances. And so he was born in Shamokin, Pennsylvania, in the coal mining region of Pennsylvania. Tough, hard-working men, hard-fighting men, hard-drinking men. But his birth was somewhat of a mystery. And so everybody knew who his father was in the family, but no one told him who his father was. Even up to the day that he died, he did not know who his father was. I asked him one time. I heard other people ask them about his father. He always had the same answer, because he was born illegitimate. That was a shame back then. A girl that had a baby out of wedlock was shamed. His mother went through a lot of terrible things. But they had to keep it a secret. He didn't know who his father was, but when he died, we asked his relatives and those that raised him, who was his father? And his father was a Catholic priest. And so I have the blood of a Catholic priest in me right now. And I don't care how many times they ask me or what gifts they send me, I will never become Pope. I guarantee you that. And so, but the thing is, I felt so bad for his mother because he would say, his answer all the time was, I was a bastard, which was a name they gave for illegitimate children back then, and my mother was a barfly. His mother died at the age of 19 of alcohol poisoning. She spent all her time in the tap room, but that's not how it was supposed to be. But because she was pregnant outside of wedlock at the age of 13, why, she couldn't go to school. She had to raise a child. She was an outcast of their community and of their Catholic society because everybody married the man who impregnated them. It's just the way it was. You get a woman, you get a girl pregnant, you marry him. No ands, ifs, and buts, that's it. End of story. You raise that child, that's your wife for life, and that's how it works. And so, but that couldn't work with her because nobody could tell. And I could understand the problem, the difficult situations. It's like if my dad was a kid and he knew that his dad was a Catholic priest, he couldn't very well go up to him and say, Father, Father, you know, I think that would cause some eyebrows to raise. But so he was raised in extreme poverty. Extreme poverty. He didn't have a male figure to help raise him, and his mother, she didn't have anybody accepted her except people in the bar rooms. And you know what happens. They take advantage of her. She drank, and she drank. I felt so, my heart grieves for my father's mother because here, the one that is supposed to represent God, the one that is supposed to reveal the kingdom of God to a child is the one that takes advantage and is the devil in disguise. And so I grieve. She had nowhere to turn to, nowhere to turn to, nobody to lead her into the path of righteousness. And I tell you what, the Bible talks about, Jesus says, it would be better that a millstone was tied around a person's neck and they were thrown into an ocean than to offend one of God's little ones. And I know there is a millstone waiting for somebody unless they have repented. But my father was no one to take care of him. He had two aunts, which were just a little bit older than he was. And they quit schools and they went and worked in sewing factories so they could raise him. And they grew up in this terrible house I visited a couple times that was up against an embankment right next to the railroad tracks. And underneath of it, they dug out part of it to get the coal to warm the house, and that's how he was raised. And as soon as he was able to, World War II came along, and every young man joined the military at that time. My mother had a different story. And so she was one of eight children, and she was number seven, and her youngest brother obviously was number eight. And they were extremely poor. And then when my mother's family moved into an abandoned house. And back then, they didn't have running water. You had a spring underneath your house, and you kept that spring running. But they went and moved into this abandoned house to live. And they got the water out, but the water was polluted. And within a week, her oldest six brothers and sisters died. They died of the water that was so bad that had killed him. It had killed him. Her mother just went emotionally, just lost it and left the family, abandoned her husband, my mother, and her younger brother. My mother and younger brother's dad, my grandfather, didn't have anywhere to go, didn't know what to do, no one to take care of the kids, so he turned the two kids over to an orphanage. And back then, in the orphanages in the 30s, the early 30s, they said it was a terrible experience as they were growing up. They said they ran away from the orphanage three times. They didn't go to school. My mother had to work in a sewing factory as a child. My uncle had to work in a shoe factory making shoes, and they would just conspire together to run away. And they always called, and they brought them back, and it was the same punishment. They put a 1x12 between their backs and put them back to back, and they tie ropes around their body, and they would sit for 24 straight hours that way until they said they wouldn't run away again or they got a chance. And so my mother was born into this orphanage system and constantly working. My father was then in the Navy. He had met my mother in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And they fell in love and they got married. And after a while, they had a baby girl. Her name was Bernadette. And 2 years went by, and then she was pregnant with me. And then one night, Bernadette got sick and died in her arms while she was pregnant with me. They were in Philly at the time. They were so devastated, they needed to go away to find a different place to live. And so they moved from Philly to the heart, the religious belt of Pennsylvania. And that was right smack dab in the Amish, Mennonite, and Quaker section of Pennsylvania where I was raised. And we had a dirt road. My dad moved into this house. We didn't have running water. We didn't have toilets. We had an outside toilet. There was no plumbing. There was no heating. We had a wood stove, and that's all we had, and a big wood pile, and we would cook everything on the wood stove, and then my mom would wash the clothes, make the water real hot, and cook them on and we get a big pail of water, and we take a bath in that, you know, once a month or whatever, you know. I still hated even doing that then as a kid, you know, but that's how I was raised, and you didn't know any better, because everybody else was like that. Nobody had electricity. Nobody had indoor toilets. My dad, though, was very, very handy with his hands. And he worked in a steel mill eventually, and became a mechanic. And so he was the first one in the whole community, to install plumbing in the house. Now, the community was like 100 years in the past. There was horse and buggies going by my house constantly with the Amish and the Old Order Mennonite, and I never thought any difference. We were the only one that had a real car, so to speak. There were some others that had cars, but I'll explain about that a little later. And so they realized my dad came from a Catholic background, and their whole history was escaping the Catholics, so they let us go. They didn't talk to us. In a way, they shunned us. We had no friends in that area. My mother was left alone. My dad worked in the steel mill. And I remember one time he went and put plumbing in, but he did something that the community thought was awful. He put in a toilet. He put in a sink in a bathroom, and he put in a bathtub. The whole problem was they said we were highfalutin. We had the devil in our house because our toilet, our sink, and our bathtub was blue. We had a blue toilet. And some of the old farmer kids would come to me, and they said, we heard you had a blue toilet. And they would come and see the toilet. And every now and then, a farmer would come down the road, and he says, can we see your blue toilet? And they come and look at our blue toilet and everything. Well, they didn't tell us to our face that we had the devil in our house because we had a blue toilet. It was the kids that told me later on. That's what the community thought about us, because they had different standards back then. And so I, at the time, was raised to believe by everybody. It was a religious. Everybody loved Billy. Why wouldn't they? Everybody loves everybody. And even though you have Amish, Quaker, and Mennonites and different orders of them, if a whole community is based upon the Word of God, it affects that community in a godly manner. So I would always go and say, Mom, bye. I was just a little boy. I'd say bye. She'd say, come home at dark. And then I would just roam all over the place. And I got a bicycle, and I would go. And if I got hungry, I would just, you know, drive my little bicycle up to somebody's house and say, I'm hungry. Will you have something to eat? And they said, sure. And I'd go in their house and they'd feed me, and I got to meet all kinds of Amish people and Mennonite people and everybody. And they would all be like, I was like the little gossip bee. You know, well, what's going on? Did you hear about that? And I'm just a little kid, you know what I mean? And but I guess in a way it was even unusual for that area, because not too many kids just went around from out of nowhere drop into the house. But they were wonderful. They took care of all my needs. And then one day, it was the Old Order Mennonite with the horse and buggy. Now, the Old Order Mennonite, obviously, the women had long dresses. They had the cap on the hair. They did not wear buttons, because buttons were a symbol of worldliness. So they had straight pins to hold their clothes together. They had their own rules and regulations. But they asked me if I wanted to go to church with them. I said, sure. So I remember I rode my bicycle out to them on a Sunday morning, and I got in the horse and buggy. And we rode in the horse and buggy to their church, where there was all horse and buggies all over the place. I remember even at that time being fascinated by all these horses and everything. And we go in the church, and the women are sitting on one side of the church. The men are sitting on the other side of the church. And I'm sitting with the men, and they had a guy come up there, and he starts preaching, talking about God. And I remember at the time, I was only 6 years old when this happened, that I was so interested. And I put my hands on the front of the pew, and I pulled myself forward so I could listen even more, because I was so interested in what the preacher was saying, when all of a sudden, I got smacked on the back of the head with a big old pole. And so what happened was, in those churches at a time, they had men who would walk around with 10-foot poles. And if you got out of line, little kids got out of line, they smack them in the head with the pole. You know, if somebody falls asleep, they smack them in the head with a pole. You know what I mean? Somebody talking out, smack them in the head with the pole. And I tell you what, after I got smacked in the head with a pole, I didn't care nothing what that preacher was saying. All I was watching was, who's he going to smack on the head next? You know what I mean? And so it was like, kids are concrete thinkers. And so if you go to church and God's not fun, I mean, if church isn't fun, then obviously God must not be fun. If you move a little bit and get smacked on the head, why, if you move a little bit away from God, he's going to smack you on the head. No fun. So I didn't want to go back to that church anymore. And so I go on my little bicycle, and I went to the Black Bumper Mennonite to go to eat with them. And the Black Bumper Mennonites were just a little bit of a different type of Mennonite. They could have cars as long as the car was black. And back then, they had chrome bumpers, you know, metal chrome bumpers, you know what I mean? You could drive them through a wall and not even mess them up. And so, but they could if they painted the bumpers black, because chrome was a sign of worldliness. And if it attracted your attention, it took your attention away from thinking about God. So they painted the door handles black. They painted around the rear view mirror black. The mirrors black. Everything was black. You know, it was chrome. So it was a big black car. And so when at the age of six, my life changed for the better. God's had an appointment for me. And the Black Bumper Mennonites came to my church. I mean, I came to my house, and they said, we want to take Billy to vacation Bible school. And my parents said, okay, that's great. I had no idea what vacation Bible school was, but I went there, and I had the most fun in my life. We played games. We did crafts. The teachers told me about Jesus. Now, my parents had a spiritual side of them. And we had pictures of Jesus in the house. We had a big Bible that you couldn't touch. And we had things around the house like that. We say, now I lay me down to sleep. And, you know, and thank you, Lord, for this food. You know, that little, God is great, God is good. Yeah, that one. And so we had a spiritual side. We just did not go to church. It was the first time I really heard about Jesus. And they told me that God loved me and Jesus loves me. And I was all excited about that. And I remembered that. And so when I left, after 2 weeks vacation Bible school, it made such an impression on my life about God that remained with me the rest of my life. And so when I left, they gave me a little graduation certificate. And this is the graduation certificate I have. I was 6 years old. I'm was 7 and September 11th, but it's right there, you can see up there. But it's signed by Anna Waite and Ephraim Nefzenger. And so, but Anna, I had thought at the time, you see, what is perceived and what is reality is two different things to the kid. To me, teacher Anna was a real, real old lady. But then I looked her up on Google, you know, a little while ago, and I found out that she must have been 23 years old when she was teaching me. But in my mind, she was an old lady. You know what I mean? But she died at the age of 84. I had just missed her by a couple months, I realized when I looked her up. And I thought that she had no idea how she affected my life by being faithful in the little things, by stepping up and volunteering. It made a difference in someone's life, no matter how small or how great it is. And God wants to use every single one of you to do part of God's work. He doesn't want you to sit around and do nothing. He wants you to do something. And you guys will, because you're here tonight. God's brought all of you here, and I'm confident of that. So I had this sense of godliness about me. And so on the other side, on my father's side, we would take me to Shamokin, Pennsylvania, and I'd stay with the relatives, his relatives, the Catholics, for 2 weeks during the summer. And the men would get up in the morning, and the women would make them breakfast, and the men would go to work, and the women would take me, and we'd go down to the pub. And all day long, we would just hang out in the pub, and they'd be drinking. And then later on, the men would come at night to the pub, and it was like a big community thing to them. And you know what? They were extremely patriotic, hardworking men, and they all fought in World War II. My mom got a little bit worried, upset, and my dad says, no, he's got to learn about these things, because when I was with them, they broke out all their military things, and they showed me pictures of the concentration camps in Germany, and they showed dead bodies stacked up, and they showed terrible things that happened over there in these camps, and terrible things that had happened to the Jews, and they said to me, and I remember this plain as day, they said, Billy, they said, this is what the devil does. And they said, and this is what the devil looks like. And they showed me a picture of Hitler. And I have to tell you the truth. This is the truth. The boogeyman never scared me, but Hitler did. Because they said, Billy, he's still alive. They never found his body. He escaped. He could be anywhere, Billy, anywhere. He could be hiding in the woods. He could be beyond that hill. And I go, Hill Hitler? And they go, yes, Hill Hitler. You know, and so, but he was the boogeyman to me. And so when I grew up, I just wanted to go out and fight for good things like they did. And man, they would get together and they'd talk about truth, justice, the American way, and alcohol in the pub. And it'd be truth, justice, and alcohol, and then truth and alcohol, and then finally just end up with alcohol. You know what I mean? So, but it was an experience. And I had fun with them. And I loved them. And then I'd come back. Did I ever tell you my grandfather was black? No, well, sort of. See, what happened was when my grandmother had left on my mother's side and left my white grandfather, when she took off, she divorced my white grandfather and she married a black man. She married a black man before I was born. And so the only grandfather I ever knew was black. And so he had his whole, we would go down to South Philly where they all were, and everybody there was black, but as a little kid, I did not see color. The only thing I saw was love. I didn't see color at all. And I'd run around South Philly on the streets with all kinds of other black boys at the time, and we had fun. You know what I mean? And they used to, and then they moved up to where we lived and built a little house over a spring and everything. My dad helped build them, and they all came up and built it together. And then some of the other black people came up, we just had so much fun together. And I got to tell you this story. Because they all had a sense of spirituality about them too. And I'll never forget this. Because it made an impression on my life forever. And we're over at my grandfather's house. And all the black families over there. Now my favorite person in the whole black family was my Aunt Carrie. I loved my Aunt Carrie. She was all soft and squishy. And she hugged me all the time. all the time. I loved her. I loved her. Well, during that night, people were there, and all of a sudden, I'm outside. Everybody starts screaming at the top of their lungs. They're freaking out and everything. And two men go running into the swamps, and I'm watching. I don't know what's going on. And they bring out this big old black snake. And the big old black snake's just wiggling in her hands and everything. Well, what happened was there was a pregnant lady there, and the black snake crossed her path as she was walking. And everybody knew that a black snake's got the devil in him. And that devil will jump into the belly of a pregnant woman's child, and that child will become out full of the devil. Now, the only way you could get rid of them, you had to get a woman in a red dress, and you waited till sundown, and she had high heels on, and when that sun went down, she stepped on the head of that snake with the high heels, and so they all stood around, and they're all singing hymns and thanking Jesus and everything, and I'm right with them, you know what I mean? And they're all doing this and asking Jesus to help them. And so my grandmother, like my white grandmother, she's hiding in the closet. She's so scared out of her mind, you know. So my Aunt Carrie had to go in, get my grandmother's red dress to put on. And she was like a bigger woman than a squish. She was like all squished out all over the place, you know. I remember when she came out. So she's there, and the sun's going down, and they're singing hymns to the Lord, and all of a sudden, the sun goes down, and she puts her heel on that snake's head, and that snake's body's just going like that, like crazy, and then they're like, it was dead, and they held it up, and it wasn't squiggling anymore, and it was like, praise the Lord, thank you, Jesus, and everything else like that, and I'm telling you, years later, I thought, where did they get all that? And yet, you look in the beginning of the Bible. You look at to the end of the Bible. And I think this is where they put it all together. They were like sheep without a shepherd at the time. They needed someone to instruct them, but they were doing the best they could by what they knew. And I tell you what. That night, I had rode my bicycle to my grandmother's house, which is about 5 miles away, to my own house. And that night, there was people testifying. There was a streak of lightning from my grandmother's house to my house, and that was me on my bicycle, because I knew that devil went somewhere, but he wasn't going to catch me. I'm telling you. He wasn't going to catch me. Well, I had a wonderful time. The Quaker girls when I went to school just loved me. But all of the Quakers around there never wore shoes. They went to school. They didn't wear shoes. Except in the extreme cold, you know, snow conditions, they would. And they were like hand-me-down shoes. But we would all sit in the bus and the Quaker girls would be around. They liked me for some reason. I don't know. Maybe because I ate a lot of oatmeal. I don't know. But anyhow, but they would be sitting around me and bare feet, and you know, we have the Amish and the Quaker and the Mennonites, and we were just all together having fun, and it was a wonderful time to grow up. I grew up in paradise. But then, when I was 11 years old, my paradise was shattered. Well, I had a blue cross above my bed, hanging on the wall, right above my bed. And one of the things I have to tell you is that when I graduated from my vacation Bible school, they gave me a little thing to hang on my wall. And it was a picture of Jesus, the Good Shepherd, holding a lamb. And beneath of it was a cross that glowed in the dark. And so I had that by my bed. And every morning when I got up, I saw Jesus, the Good Shepherd. And when I went to bed at night, I seen the cross glowing in the dark till I fell asleep. There was a cross above my bed made out of glass. It was blue. And then when I was 11 years old, I was woke up in the middle of the night, and I heard something, and there was glass all over me, and the light came on. My father was with my mother, and she said, I had to do it. The voices told me to do it, and she had taken that glass and broke it over my bedpost, and the glass had shattered all over me. And at that time, my mother went mentally ill. Not only did my mother go mentally ill, she went extremely, mentally ill, where she starts walking around the house at night, and she's talking to voices, and the voices are talking to her, and she's laughing in the middle of the night all the time, and you can't sleep. And then my mother didn't take care of herself. She was like completely detached from everything, and she started to smell really bad, and it was awful. It was embarrassing for me to have a mother like that. And I had two sisters and a little brother. And the voices told her, and this was even more embarrassing, they said not to take care of anybody but Billy. And so she wouldn't make meals for me. She would take care of my clothes. She would do things, but not my dad, not my sisters, not my brothers, for whatever reason. And I felt like there was resentment, and I didn't want my mom to single me out. And I used to come out of the house, and if my mom was there, I used to run into the woods because I was just so embarrassed because of my mom. And she would go wandering off, and the farmers would bring her back and said, she's out talking to the cows. Or she wandered off again, and somebody else would bring her back. And she got progressively worse. And then my father, in desperation, decided to go back to the Catholic Church. Well, there wasn't any Catholic Church in the area. And so we had to travel quite a distance to go to a Catholic Church. Well, I, at the time, 11 years old, I was in seventh grade. I was actually the youngest person to start my grade school. And I was the youngest kid in my class throughout school, and I was 11 years old. I was in seventh grade, and I had to go to catechism class, which I knew nothing about. And so I'm in there with a bunch of small kids, and they're all saying, Hail Mary, full grace, Lord be with you, blah, blah, blah. And so they're all saying that. I'm not trying to be disrespectful by any means. Please forgive me if you think I am, but I'm not. But I had no idea what they were saying, and all the kids were looking at me, and like, why aren't you saying that? You're an old kid. Why don't you know these things? And once again, I'm kind of embarrassed. And then I asked the nun at the time, this is verbatim. I said, I don't understand. Why do you put so much emphasis on Mary when the Bible's all about Jesus, and Jesus is the Son of God, and Jesus is the way to heaven? And I learned that from being in my vacation Bible school, and that left an impression on me, that stayed with me. And she said, you are not supposed to question what we tell you. You are only supposed to believe what we tell you. Well, at the time, I didn't want to be there, and as a seventh grader, I just started breaking down crying. I couldn't stop, and I was so embarrassed because I'm crying, an old kid. So they brought down the priest, and the priest gave me private catechism lessons, because I was a disruption to class. And then it came time for my first confession. As I went into my first confession, I was really a good kid. I'm not saying I was perfect, but I just really was a good little boy. And I was innocent in a lot of things. And I got in there, and the Catholic priest started asking me things that were filthy and vile and dirty. And he started asking me a bunch of sexual things because I had some neighbor girls. Did you ever do this to the neighbor? No, I'd never heard of these things. And did you ever do that? And no, I never did it. And when I was done, I came out. I couldn't even look at him in the face. I was so ashamed. I felt so dirty inside with what he did to me. He took away my innocence. He took away my innocence. Now, I'm not picking on the Catholics. I'm only telling you about my life experience. But it changed me. I didn't want to go to that church anymore. I just didn't want to be involved with them anymore. And I hated going to the Catholic Church. My mother got progressively worse. And then it got to the point where they took her and she tried to kill my sisters. My dad stopped her. She had a knife. I saw it. She was chasing my sisters, and she said, the voices said to kill my sisters, and she was going to kill my sisters and my little brothers. And my dad stopped her and held her. And right before then, the voices had told her to burn every picture of Jesus in the house. So I was back, and in an old trash barrel that we had, it was a big 50-gallon drum that we burned trash in. She was burning pictures of my sisters and my father and my little brother, but not touching my pictures. She burnt every picture of Jesus. I saw that it was happening, and I couldn't understand why she did that. My father, in desperation, called up the priest. The priest said, we need to have an exorcism. They brought four priest for to have an exorcism for my mother. And they took two of my aunts, her half-sisters. It was my Aunt Gina and my Aunt Lavada went with them to the priest. And then they came back and they told me what happened. That as the priest wanted to exorcise the demons out of my mom started screaming and she attacked the priest until the priest couldn't hold her anymore. And they had to call the people from Emeryville, which was the insane institution at the time. Abbott and Costello had a routine about it. I heard later on, always hurt my heart about being trapped in Emeryville. But it's where the crazy people were. And they came and they put a white coat on her and they took her out. And then we had to visit my mother in Emeryville. And when I visit my mother in Emeryville, I'm just a little kid with my two little sisters. I'm 11, my two little sisters and my little brother. And we're all huddling, you know, together. And people would coming up, all people. And they're just, it's like Susan Hayward was in a movie called The Snake Pit, where crazy people are all around. That's how it was. It was just crazy people all around there talking to each other and walking and making noises and being crazy. And they came up to me all the time, and my little sisters, you got a cigarette, you got a cigarette, you got a cigarette. And we're just little kids. And it just proves to me right now that anyone who smokes cigarettes is crazy, okay? So, you know, mental illness devastated my family. It tore my family apart. It destroyed my family. My poor father loved my mother, did everything he could, but my mother to him, my mother did not, in her mind, have a husband. He didn't exist. No one existed but me. And so my father was lonely. My mother was in an institution. And so eventually things happened. He met another woman. He tried to stay away, but he craved female companionship, and things just happened. And then my dad emotionally kind of lost his mind. He got so caught up in this other woman, he was trying to keep it a secret. And then he went and basically ran away with her, and not far. But here, me, my two sisters, and my little brother are left alone in a house to care for ourselves. And I'm only 11 years old, going on 12, when all this happened. And he would bring us food. And he made sure somebody took us to school, but he's living with another woman. And so when I was 11, something happened. And somebody took me to a roller skating rink just so I could get away from everything and my sisters. And at age 11, I saw a little girl roller skating with beautiful blonde hair who was also 11, and I fell in love for the rest of my life. And so it was the first time I saw Bonnie. And I tell you what, girls were just playmates. They were whiny boys. But when I saw her, everything was different. It was an immediate that I just seemed like I bonded with her. And I met her, and it was instantaneous for her too. It was like she bonded with me. And Bonnie had her own story. Bonnie was raised into a family where her father couldn't keep a job. He had a hard time. She had brothers and sisters, and he just went from job to job. And I have a article I want to read. I'll put it up on the board here. But it was taken out of a newspaper clipping in Fort Worth, Texas, where we had it blown up. And I'll just read it as you can read it. It says, 40 cents in a broken-down car. Tent harbors six children while laborer seeks work. A 28-year-old father whose car was pushed 90 miles to Fort Worth by sympathizers when it broke down doesn't know how he's going to get out of the toughest spot I've ever been in. George Popper got to Fort Worth with 40 cents in his pocket. That was Thursday. And since then, he pounded the pavement looking for people needing unskilled labor. But daily, he's gone home jobless to a 14 by 15-foot tent his family of six, including a set of twins 3 months old, is living in at 466 South Main Street, a tent they're in danger of being evicted from. Popper, who worked here several years ago and then moved to Pennsylvania because the climate there caused a baby daughter, Bonnie, to be sick, left Pennsylvania more than 3 weeks ago to find a job here that would better support his family. He was working there as a farmhand for $45 a week. A family treaded its way across the country with Popper working at odd jobs. They were pushed bumper to bumper by residents and cars along the way from Oklahoma. Some old friends at South Main address, Reverend Rhymes Bennett and her husband, W.A. Bennett, a Texas and Pacific Railroad engineer and fireman, set up the family up in a tent equipped with two half beds and an old cook stove. One of the twins is sleeping in a cardboard box propped on two wooden chairs. Mosquito bites cover the children top to toe. A complaint has been made to the health and fire department that the tent is a hazard. And that was Bonnie's life for her childhood as she was growing up. They went from place to place. They would move into abandoned houses. And that's how they lived. And her dad would work if he could. If he couldn't work, he stole. And that lifestyle caught up with him because he got caught siphoning gasoline out of the car in the wrong state. And they put him in jail for 3 years. For 3 years. So the mom's left with all these children. And it was the only time Bonnie says they had stability in her life. They moved back to PA. And then Bonnie basically spent her childhood education in a one-room Amish schoolhouse where all the grades were all together, just like Little House on the Prairie, but all the Amish kids were there. And that's how she rose until her dad got out of prison. Not long after he got out of prison, he was working under his car. He had it up on blocks, and the blocks fell, and it crushed and killed him at the age of 10. So on that very day that I met her, somebody brought her to the roller skating rink to forget about what happened to her dad. I was brought to the roller skating rink to forget about what happened to the mom. And God brought us together. And so I would see Bonnie every single chance I got. When my life was disintegrating around me, Bonnie was the only constant in my life. We were boyfriend and girlfriend forever, and we grew up together, but I had a patriotic spirit in me, and the World War II, I would listen to the stories all the time, and as soon as I turned 17 years old, I joined the military. I left on the military, and I served in Vietnam. In between that time in the military, I married Bonnie. We had a baby boy, and then after the military, I came back to Bonnie, and I worked after Vietnam. I worked to provide for Bonnie, and soon we had another child, our second boy. But things were hard for me. I was working two jobs, but we weren't getting ahead. We weren't getting anywhere. And then I found in the early 70s, there's a jobs on the pipeline in Alaska. You could go there, you could make a lot of money. I talked to Bonnie about it. They said in Philadelphia, there's this place you could go to and they'll give you all the information. You can get your job if you go there. So I went to Philly. I paid the money. I got all the information to go to Anchorage, Alaska to start a new life. Bonnie says, Billy, do it. And I felt compelled to go there. Like I had no choice. Like I was pushed to go there. I had to leave. And so on December 27th, 1973, I said goodbye to my family. Bonnie found a place to stay with the two kids. I said goodbye, and I hitchhiked. Instead of flying to Anchorage, I was hitchhiking from Pennsylvania to Alaska, and I had $30 in my pocket. And as soon as I left Pennsylvania, you see, I grew up in really this farming community, religious belt. Even though I was in the Navy, I wasn't really getting any education on drugs. It just wasn't happening. But as soon as I left Pennsylvania and I got to Maryland, I got picked up by this guy, and he says to me, you want a bowl, man? And I says, a bowl of cereal? What are you talking about? He says, no, you take a pipe, you put marijuana in it, and that's a bowl. And I said, oh, no, because I just knew that stuff was bad. And I didn't want any parts of it. And so every single car, it seemed, that picked me up had drugs in it. I got down to Texas. As I'm hitchhiking through Texas, I got in a car, station wagon. A bunch of guys are in the car, and they're going 90 miles an hour down the highway. Because I looked at the speedometer, 90 miles an hour. I'm getting a little worried when all of a sudden the red lights are behind us flashing. It's Texas Rangers. They're chasing us and everything. And finally, the guys stopped. They get us all out of the car. They got us against the car. They got handcuffs on us. They got this guy. He's big. He's fat. He's got a crew cut. He's got a cigar in his mouth. And that's the truth, just like in the movies.
We caught you guys. You guys are going to be in big trouble. I thought you could speed in Texas. Well, that's not going to happen around here, boys. You know? And then he had this big old guy. Looked like he was like, you know, 25 years old, ex-Marine, you know, muscles all over the place, crew cut. You know, he's the one, he pushes us all back in the station wagon, and he drives us to this little town in Texas, and I am not kidding, it's like something out of a John Wayne movie, because he takes us to the jail, and the jail is like a square building, and it's got bars in the front, and it looks like a jail right out of the westerns, like the Indians and the cowboys and, you know, High Noon and everything else, and they take us in there, and they put us in jail. Well, what happened was, when the Texas Rangers were chasing us in the car, these guys had drugs. They're throwing drugs out the window, and the guy sitting beside me, he's just like eating them, you know? Popcorn! You know? So I'm in the jail. All of a sudden, that guy who had ingested all the drugs, he starts freaking out. He's foaming at the mouth. He's barfing. He's yelling. He's screaming. He's bouncing off the walls. I'd never seen anything like that, except when a dog got rabies back in Pennsylvania. You had to shoot him in the head, you know what I mean? But nobody's going to shoot this guy in the head, but they should have. Anyhow, so he's plumb going crazy. I just spent up there all night like that. And then the next morning, they come to me and they said, William York? Yeah. If I come out there, you sure you never did anything wrong in your life? I said, I never done anything wrong in my life. I'm a good boy. And they go, you're the only one that came back with a clean record. All these guys are for drugs in Florida and across the United States. You're lucky, boy. We're going to let you out, but you better get out of Texas as fast as you can. I says, I'm going to be out of Texas as fast as I can. I promise, I promise, I promise, I promise. And man, they let me go. And I'm going down the highway, and I'm paranoid as all get out. Anything that looks like a cop car, I'm jumping off the freeway. I'm jumping into the bushes, and I'm doing all my traveling kind of like at night, just making sure, and hitchhiking, you know, just to get out of Texas. I'm so glad to get out of Texas, but I'm looking forward because I'm going to be landing in California soon. I'm pushing east. I mean west. I'm going west. I'm going west. California, Beach Boys, surfboards, ocean, palm trees, all that kind of stuff. I'm so excited. I come into California and I hit Barstow. And in Barstow, this is California. There's no Beach Boys. There's no beach. There's no surf. There's palm trees, I guess. And so I'm so disappointed. But I'm going through Barstow when behind me, I'm walking down the road, behind me, and I thought, what now? Now look, here's the cop car here. Two guys came up, come up to me, say Los Angeles. I go, Los Angeles? And they go, where are you from? Pennsylvania. Where are you going? Alaska? Okay. And then he just turned around and went. And I tell you what, I narrowly escape being deported back to Pennsylvania by way of Mexico, because that was my first encounter with the Border Patrol at the time. So I, you know what, I'm hitchhiking, I'm going down, and I'm landing in my first city, San Bernardino. And I'm walking through San Bernardino, and I'm thinking, wow, what a beautiful place. What was I thinking? You know, but anyhow, I'm walking through San Bernardino, and this was God. God had another appointment for me, because as I'm walking downtown, it's like God turned my head, and I happened to look, and it was the employment office, and they had a big poster on the employment office, and it said, no jobs in Alaska, highest unemployment rate in the nation, don't go there, inquire within. I'm going to Alaska for a job. I go inside. They said, there's no jobs in Alaska. They said, somebody's lying to you. And they said, there's companies falsifying information. They're able to get around it, but they're not telling you the truth. And they're taking your money. And they said, where did you get this information? I said, Philadelphia. They said, that's one of the places. That's one of the places. There's nothing waiting up there for you. Nothing. So I didn't know what to do. I just registered at the employment office trying to get work. And so I'm looking all around. After a while, I'm running out of money. I'm looking for jobs every day. There was no place for me to stay. I am sleeping in the cemetery off Waterman. There's a cemetery. I'm sleeping in the cemetery, and that's where my home, the cemetery. But at no time did I ever feel I was homeless.
I was just in transit. I was going to find something. It didn't matter. I was going to find something. And after a while, I ran out of money. And I'm eating oranges out of the orange groves to stay alive. That is the only thing I was eating. It's a great way to clean out your intestines, you know? But that's how it is. And I'm looking for work all the way. But you know, there was a big Jesus movement happening in Southern California at the time. But along with the Jesus movement, there was counterfeits everywhere. There was the Moonies who were on the corner. Now, I liked the Moonies. They were like the little Korean fellows, and they were selling flowers. I would help them sell flowers because I liked them. They were always smiling. I couldn't understand them. But we, you know, it was good. It was good. And then there was the Krishnas in the bus stop, and they were crazy. I never liked them. And then there was a group coming around called the Children of God. They had a prophet named David Moses at the time, and they were just too weird for me. But one night, I'm so lonely. I'm trying to find anything. It's dark. I'm walking along the road, and a van comes up, stops beside me. Guy rolls down the window, and he says, "Hey, are you looking for a change in life? Are you looking for something to change your life? Are you looking for hope? Are you looking for something to change your life forever?" I go, "Yeah." And I go, "Well, come in, stop in. I want to tell you more." And he's telling me, "This can change your life. You want to come with me and have your life changed?" And I go, "Okay." You know, so he takes me to this place, and we come in the house, and there's some young people there, and they're all smiling, and they're all happy. They say, "Sit down," and we're sitting down on the floor, and they make a circle, and they're talking about the changes in their life. They did this one thing, and it changed their life forever. They do it, and it's wonderful. You got to do it too. And I'm thinking, what? What? They said, "Your life is all messed up because you are out of the universal river of life. You are sitting on the banks. And so you got to get back into that river. And if you get back into that river, you're gone with the river. Your whole life's going to flow." And I'm thinking, well, I had a lot of fun at the creek when I was a kid. So maybe this is good, you know. So I said, and then they said, "They're Buddhists." They said, "All you have to do is chant Nam-myoho Renge So, Nam-myoho Renge So." And so, okay. And so they said, "Okay, let's go into the room." And so they went to another room, big living room. And as I enter it, why, they have an altar up front. And it's all covered in gold. And they got idols there. And they got incense burning. And they got chimes going. And they gave me beads. And they said, "Take off your shoes right now, because it's a holy place in here." And so I took off my shoes. And like the guy picked me up, he was like the high priest. And he went over there, and the next thing I know, he's like, "They're, you know, says, rub your beads together and go up and down and say, Nam-myoho Renge So, Nam-myoho Renge So." And that's what I was doing. I was going, "Nam-myoho Renge So," but I wasn't very good at it. I get so confused because I go, "Nam-myoho Renge So, Hail Mary, full of grace, Nam-myoho Renge So." Anyhow. But he said, "You got this parchment of paper. Take this paper back where you're living, and you post it on the wall, and you just keep doing that for hours and hours, and your whole life will change." Well, before that, I did have a little bit of change, because I met this guy, and he said, "Listen, you need money? You don't have none. Go down and give plasma twice a week, you know?" And so I gave plasma twice a week, $6 a shot, $12. And this guy says, "I got this little room, it's like a closet in the back of my house. You can stay in that closet. Give me the $12. So I said, "Okay." So I went down, gave plasma to fall. Everybody was like an alcoholic back there, just waiting to get another bottle or something. But not me. I just wanted to live, you know. So I'm giving plasma twice a week. I gave the money, you know, to the guy. And so I go back to my closet. I put this thing on the wall. I'm going, "Nam-myoho Renge So, Nam-myoho Renge." You got to say it like that. "Nam-myoho Renge So." And I think, "Nam-myoho Renge So." This is so stupid. And I quit. That was it. This is so stupid. And I didn't want that in my life. And so then I'm going around, and finally I go down to the employment office, and they said, "We found you a job out in Edgemont working in a trailer factory, because you worked in a trailer factory back in Pennsylvania." And I says, "I'll be there. I'll be there." And so I took my backpack and my sleeping bag, and I thought, I am just going to sleep out in the dirt, in the field, behind a shed or something for 2 weeks until they pay me, just so I could get some money. And so I took it out there, and I thought, in the meantime, I'm going to ask anybody if somebody lives in San Bernardino. And I'm asking everybody. But you know, my first day at lunchtime, I'm there, and I'm staring. All these brown people are sitting around me. And I said, I can't figure something out. They said, what is it? I said, how did all you Cubans get out here to California? They said, Cubans? Said, we're Mexicans. We're no Cubans, you know? I said, Mexico, that's a foreign country. They said, yeah. But you see, I just never occurred to me. I thought they were all in Texas, though, over here. But anyhow, that's just a side note. But anyhow, so anyhow, I'm asking all around, does anybody live in San Bernardino? And he said, yeah, this one guy does. So I went over to this one guy. He's a big guy. And he was mad at the time. And he was putting together a petition that went wrong. He ripped the petition off the trailer. He threw it down. He broke it up. He took his hammer. He busted it. He's kicking it and everything. And I said, what do you want? And I said, can you give me a ride back to San Bernardino? He said, no, get out of my face. So I left, you know. And then he comes up to me a little later. And he says, you know, I'm a Christian. And he said, I was just having a bad moment. And he said, God told me to give you a ride. I said, okay, you know. And so he was a Christian going to Calvary Chapel Riverside. And he's telling me all about the Lord every single time on every ride. And he's singing songs to me that he sung in church. And one of them he would sing over and over again that would be like, I never heard anything like this. How can you sing without a hymn book? And he would sing, I want more Jesus, more and more and more. I want more Jesus than I ever did before. And he would sing that faster and faster and faster and faster. And I go home at night and I could get that song out of my mind. You know what I mean? I want more Jesus, more and more and more. Get out of my mind, get out of my mind, you know? So anyhow, but he says to me about God. He's telling me about it. He's witnessing to me. And I'm listening and I'm listening and I'm listening. But at work, not eating was getting to me. And I start passing out. I stand up and I pass out. And then I go blank and go gray. And I get up and start working again. And then one day he asked me to come home with him. And he fed me. And it was like I couldn't stop eating. I ate everything that they had on the table. And I ate the loaf of bread. Every piece of loaf of bread, I ate it all. And then he says, you know, you need money or something? I said, yeah. And I thought, maybe he's going to give me money. He says, just ask God. He's got the cattle on 1,000 hills. He'll give you all the money you want. And I said, okay. And so I went back and to where I was living, and I said, God, I don't know if I really believe in you, but I believe in what Jerry says about you, and I need money. I need money. And so what happened was the very next day, I got an envelope in the mail from the employment office because I gave them my address, and it was for $90-some from the state of Pennsylvania. I was unemployed for a little while in there, and they sent me an unemployment check. It was just enough to carry me over so I didn't die. And I was so excited. And I told the person that I was living with, I said, look, this is what God did for me. This is what God did to me. And I couldn't wait to hear about God. And he says, you got to come to church with me. And I says, I can't. I says, look at me. I'm dirty. I'm filthy. I'm unclean. Look at my clothes. I can't go with that. I was embarrassed because of myself. And he goes, God doesn't care about what you wear on the outside. He just cares about your heart. And says, come on to church. And so he finally talked me into it. And that night, he wore his dirty work clothes to church with me. And I go in there, and I'm waiting. And they're singing these songs I'd never heard before. How could they sing without hymn books? And I love it. I'm hearing these things. And he says, wait till you see our Pastor Greg. Pastor Greg Laurie's going to come out. Greg Laurie's going to come out. And then Greg Laurie came out. And he had long hair down to his shoulder, a big old beard. And I thought, Greg Laurie's an Amish man? That's what I thought. I thought there's Amish men out here. And so I was interested. But then Greg starts teaching out of the Bible. And I've never heard anyone really teach out of the Bible. And he said, you have got to ask God into your heart. Ask Jesus into your heart. He will save you. You will go to heaven. And I was just so excited. And I remember I left and I went home. And that night I got on my knees. And from the time it was dark till it was morning light, all night long, I said, Jesus, come into my heart. Please don't leave. Please don't leave. Please don't leave. Please don't leave. Come into my heart. Come in. I was afraid if he came in, he might not like it. Go out. You know what I mean? So I just said, but please, please, please. All night long, I prayed for him to come in. And now I'm excited. Now I got to get hold of Bonnie. I don't have anything to offer her. But I got God. And God has the cattle on 1,000 hills. He's going to take care of her. She's going to take care of me. And so I got hold of a mutual friend, got hold of Bonnie. She eventually found out where I was staying. They had a phone. They called me. I says, Bonnie, you got to come out here to California. And she says, why? I said, because they got God out here. And she goes, I thought God was everywhere. I said, no, he's out here in Riverside, California. I know it. And she says, okay. So she gets some money. She's coming out. I have nowhere for her to go. I'm just thinking God's got the cattle on 1,000 hill. So I said to my friend, I'm going to go. I don't have any money. But I want to find a place for Bonnie. And I prayed that night for God to help me. He said, well, what did you pray? We were going to go on the bicycles the next day. It was Saturday. To look for a place for my family. And I prayed. I said, God, I need a house fully furnished with everything in it because we have nothing. I want 3 months free rent because I have no money. And I want it on the same street as my friend Jerry because this God stuff is great stuff, you know? And I told Jerry that. And he goes, ooh, okay. You know? I mean, here I'm a Christian, you know? He didn't want to, like, discourage me. And so we get on the bicycles. We go, like, 100 yards down the street. And here's this guy, Rick, in the yard. And he says, hey. Jerry says to the guy, whatever happened to the old people that lived in there? He says, the old man died. The old woman, they put her in a home. She died. And it's the son. He has a place now. He lives in Oxnard. He's really rich. He's looking for somebody to rent it, but they want to get the right people in there. He said, this is the right person right here, me. And so he said, okay, I'll call him up. And so the next day he comes up. On a Sunday, the guy comes down. And he said, well, you know what? My folks haven't been here in a long time. He says, all I want is the pictures of my family on the wall. You can have everything fully furnished, and the place needs cleaned up. It's really dusty. I'll give you 3 months free rent, you know? So here it was, 3 months free rent, you know what I mean? It has everything in it. On the street where my friend Jerry lives, and Jerry comes to me, looks at me and says, I don't mind God blessing you, but this is ridiculous, you know? So then Bonnie comes out. She comes out, and I pick her up at the bus station. I bring her to the place. She can't believe we've never had a house as beautiful as this, anything like this. And then we take her to church. It was Wednesday. We brought her to church. And boy, I tell you what. She was there 5 minutes, and tears are coming down her eyes, and she knew this is where God wanted her to be. And we had 2 kids, and Greg Laurie says, how many of you are single in the church? And hands go up all over the place. And so people are checking each other out, seeing who's available. And then he says, all right, how many of you are married? And then, you know, just a few hands go up. And he says, how many of you have children? Half those hands go down. Our hands are up in the air. You know, I'm 23, she's 22. Greg Laurie's younger than us. And he says, all right, those of you that have kids, you're Sunday school teachers. And we thought, must be how it works. What do we know, you know? And so, here we are. I tell you, the very first week we're in church, we're working Sunday school, and we never stop. We never stop. So here's what I want to say. God uses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. He brings Greg Laurie up to be the preacher. He brings a couple all the way across the United States who basically have nothing to help start the children's ministry. And I give myself no credit. All glory goes to God. I mean it with all my heart. And so we are all members of one body. God has each given us a gift. He wants us to be faithful in the gift that we have. And he wants us to say, God, here I am. Use me. Use me. And I think that's all he wants. Because in the beginning, I didn't know anything about the Bible. I just wanted to serve the Lord and learn as much as I could about him. And this scripture always means so much to me. Mark 10:29, Jesus says, truly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or farms for my sake and for the gospel's sake, but that he will receive 100 times as much now in the present ages, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and farms, along with persecution, and in the age to come, eternal life. And so I look out here and I look at all the brothers I have gained. When Bonnie and I came, we found a home. We found a family. We found a place to belong. And we found the words to eternal life. And I know it doesn't stop here, because someday this other scripture will be true. And after this, I looked, and before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. And they were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. And one day, together with all the other people and all the other churches throughout the world, we will be united. But until then, we want to work for the Lord, because I know you as well as I, what we want to hear is that day when we see him face to face and he says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." I thank you for this time to be with you. I'm excited about you guys and what you're doing for the Lord. And I'm so blessed by Pastor Brad. And he loves you guys so much. I was hearing how he talked about you. And I thought, wow, it's so exciting to have a pastor whose heart truly is dedicated to your spiritual growth. So God bless you and thank you with all my heart.